Hello and welcome to Landscape Photography World, the podcast for everyone passionate about landscape photography. I'm Grant Swinburne and I'll be your host on the show, talking to landscape photographers about their motivations, likes and dislikes. Dean McGuire is an Australian fine art photographer who has an obsession with black and white imagery. Dean purchased his first camera back in 2008 and after trial and error found himself falling into love with all things landscape photography. Since that time, he's been forever perfecting the craft, as there is always so much to learn. Join us for an insightful journey into Dean's world of black and white fine art imagery. He shares his evolution from family-inspired beginnings to finding solace and expression through photography. We delve into his transition to a fine art style, ethical manipulation techniques, and pivotal moments shaping his aesthetic. We explore his projects, workflow, and strategies for overcoming creative blocks. Dean emphasizes the significance of passion, persistence, and authenticity in artistic vision, along with lots more.
Hey, Dean. Welcome to Landscape Photography World. How are you going?
I'm good, mate. How are you today?
Yeah, very good. Very good. Pleasure to have you on the show. Been a fan of your podcast and also a fan of your work for a little while. Let's start not with the podcast. We'll start with the photography. Where did photography kick off for you, and how did you get into it?
It's a real hard one for me with in regards to where it started, because I think it's always been there in my past as photography. Because I found out in a later date when I was a bit older, I think my dad used to do a bit of photography, and so did his father with the old box Brownie, and my dad had a little Pentax film camera.
Sure,
but he gave it up when I was born, so that was 35 years ago. Poor fella. So I think it was always lingering there, but without me really noticing.
Yeah, right.
I think I first picked up a little camera. Like, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, like we're middle income earners, my parents were. So they had just those little Kodak point and shoots sort of thing back in the day. They just go to Kmart and develop your film. And I think they had one of those, and I think I just picked up one of those when I was a kid and fell in love with it. And I think went from there. I actually bought my first camera when I was about 18 years old.
Right, okay.
My parents wanted to get me one when I was a bit younger, but I was real stubborn and I said, no, I want to do this and pay for it myself and make my way.
Awesome.
When I was 18, I was able to pick up my credit card and, well, not my credit card, my bank card, and go and buy one. So I bought my first camera was a Fujifilm S5 Pro. So it was an APS-C camera.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure it was modeled off the old Nikon D200 because it had a Nikon F-mount on it.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, so it was quite handy. Like I had this real nice colors coming out of the Fuji system with Nikon glass. So
it was very cool.
So yeah, it started for me when I was about 18 years old.
Yeah, okay. So what does it mean to you now? What is photography in your life?
For me now? Yeah, it's a good question. I'd say it's an escape. When I got my license, I used to surf a lot too. So I used to go out to the beach, and that was my escape, was the surfing. And then I used to go out for 2, 3, 4 hours at a time. So time, as you grow up, you get a job and that becomes a priority. So I needed that outlet. So when I was 18, I picked up the camera, and then it started becoming my escape instead of the surfing. So it quickly replaced. So it's my time, my escape from reality. Go out, I can shoot, create. And there's no external thoughts at that period of time. So, it's a reality check, really.
And what motivates you creatively? Is it the creation of art? Is it the documentation of what you're seeing out in the world? What kind of grabs your attention and makes you do what you do?
It's a real hard one, really, because I can't really say mine's documentation. It's quite fine art, really. Full disclosure, I do manipulate my photos pretty rapidly. The subject stays the same, so I don't really touch the subject as such. Yeah. It's more the background to bring the subject out. But for me, when I first started, I wanted to be everything natural. I wanted to go down that real Ken Duncan route, who was obviously still an icon.
Yeah.
And without knowing it, he's a mentor to a lot of photographers of our generation. So I really wanted to go down that natural route and really showcase what the Australian landscape was. But now what motivates me is really bringing out the subject detail of what's sitting in front of me, and also creating a product or an image that is different to what everyone else has seen. Like, For instance, we've all gone down, and well, not all of us, but a lot of us have gone down to Bermagui and taken a photograph of Camel Rock, Horsehead Rock. I think you've been there recently. I was down there
a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those locations that it doesn't matter how many times you shoot it. It's fantastic.
Absolutely.
You have so much fun down there. And
I could happily go down there for months on end if I could.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So take that sort of for instance. It's how, what might drives me is how can I get this image, like this location and subject in a different light? And that's what I try to strive for is, it's not to be different for different sake. It's just to be different for a creative sake. And the way I approach my work is, will I print this on and put this on my wall? And that's how I determine what I create and what I capture. So kind of a obscure answer, but yeah, so mine is all is art-driven based more than capturing and documenting.
Yeah, cool. And in that, where did you mention you started trying to stay with that natural path, and at some point you changed. What was that point, and what was the trigger for that?
It was a black and white photograph I took of at Narrabeen, at North Narrabeen Pool. I was shooting from a bit further back, up on the ramp that goes down, for those who know Narrabeen well, which would be a lot of Sydney side photographers and Western Sydney photographers, like they know that spot a lot, quite well, I should say. So I was sitting back at the ramp before it drops down to the pool, and it was this nice storm rolling through with a cool cloud, real dark, ominous looking cloud.
Yep.
And I just took it in black and white. Like, I'd always had this passion for black and white, and that was the defining point for me. It's just like, I like this better than what I like it in black and in color.
Yeah.
And that's where it really pinpointed. So that would have been probably about a year or so into me shooting. So very early in the piece. And yeah, so that's where it started for me, like this direction. I kept it in under wraps for a fair while because of the whole Instagram popularity thing. I fell for that trap and just kept on producing these color bombs and all that sort of stuff.
Black and white doesn't get the likes, does it?
It didn't. No, it didn't. Still doesn't. It does, but it doesn't at the moment. But
yeah, it's got a niche there, but it's not as popular as the color bombs. It's just
correct. Like, yeah, that's right. It doesn't stand out and grab your attention. So unless you're looking at it. But yeah, so that I really put it to the side and did it in the background and trained myself up to where I am today with it. So it's taken me all this time to really teach myself.
Yeah, right.
Back then there was no one doing it. It was real taboo. Very big in Europe and England. They had the awesome conditions for that sort of style. But here in Australia, there wasn't. Everyone was so influenced by people like Ken Duncan and even people. Oh, there's so many people to name. I can't even mention. We all know who they are. But yeah, it was taboo. I loved it. So I kept doing it on the side until I was happy and really happy to and comfortable to push that product out. Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Are you more along the lines of planning your shots and pre-visualizing, or do you go spontaneously with what the conditions are and what's in front of you?
It depends. If I'm going to somewhere like Cathedral Rocks, where I want to go all the way across to the far side and shoot the two stacks, I'll be paying attention to tides and what the swell's doing. And I think that goes for not just my photography, that goes for a lot of landscapers. They should really pay attention to what the swell's doing.
Yeah, definitely.
Tides are doing, because anything, and sit there and watch it for a couple of minutes before you go out. We've all been whacked with a rogue wave. So if you can prolong that, then you're doing the right thing. So if I'm doing places like that where safety is a concern, I will sit down and I'll meticulously go through all the weather, what's doing. Right. But a lot of my work these days, mate, I'm doing it from a car park or I'm doing it from a beach front because it's real minimal. So I don't need to walk into these places. So mostly I'm looking at clouds to prepare, whether it's going to be a cloudless day or there's going to be overcast. That'll change where I go. As a standpoint to be where I'm going, I don't really plan it as such. It's just mostly where safety is concerned is where I'll sit down and really think about it.
And how important is it to you to have projects in your photography? Do you have projects or do you just shoot what comes?
I do both.
Okay.
And I'm not sure exactly where a lot of other people stand. I've heard you say you're into projects, you like them.
And I do. I also love just gun and shooting sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Luck of the draw is a good thing sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. So I've got two projects going at the same time, but I really like a project and I also like just going out and shooting. So I think they're important to photographers in a way because it stops you from getting stale. In a way with your photography and getting that creative block as a lot of us have had in the past. So at the moment, I've got my two projects I've got going at the moment. One's called 141, which is just square crops. And that's just of different locations. And that's in color and black and white. And that's just a project because I love a good square. Yeah,
exactly. I love it, particularly when you've got something minimal or abstract.
Yep. Yeah, it works perfectly. Yep.
Yeah.
Even some nice square waterfalls where your waterfall directly in the center with some nice trees around it looks fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But so that's a little project I've got going on at the moment. That's ongoing. That'll never stop. And then I've got this one that really is the project, if I could call it the project, and that's called Deep End.
Right.
And that one is a little bit more technical because it's all it is pools, square pools. So I've got to go find a location like a pool, which in Sydney, New South Wales, all the way through the East Coast, we've got abundance of them.
44 or 45 of them just in Sydney.
That's right. That's on the northern beaches alone. that one's actually started a few years back now, pre-COVID. Right. That one is fun. That's tricky because there's a lot of images out there of the pool. North Narrabeen pool, like how many of the photographs are there of that place?
I posted one yesterday.
You did? I saw that. And funny enough, I don't think there's that many images from that angle shooting back towards the coastline from that angle. There is shooting back directly to the headland to where the pool and where you jump into the pool and stuff like that, but not quite from that angle. Yeah. So that was a little bit different.
Well, thank you.
Kudos to that.
What got my eye was actually the sky had lit up a bit pink over in that direction. Mm-hmm. Because the sunrise was out to the left of the image.
Yep.
The sun had popped, but the sky still had a bit of pink in it down in the clouds there. And I just liked the look at it it and just lined it up, put a 10 stopper on and did it. I think it was a minute 7 or minute 10 or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good length. It's a good length. But yeah, no, and that's the also positive part about just going out and shooting what's in front of you. So if you were going there as a project, you could be shooting away and go, but that's where you to take the blinkers off.
Yeah.
You're looking and go, then you can pivot and change if you're shooting for that color in the sunset. But I'm quite stubborn. So if there's a mad sunset going on, I won't be shooting it because I've got this vision in my head to a degree. Once I get there, I know what I want. I don't have in my collection these days, I don't have any sunrises, any sunsets. So that's not what I'm going for in my work. So I'm just going to sit here, take a photo, a 5-minute exposure over a sunrise and just sit back and enjoy it as being there present.
Yeah, nice.
It sounds strange for a landscape photographer to not want to take a photo of a sunset or a sunrise, but
I think it's very laudable. It's a different approach.
Yeah.
What does success look like in your photography? What you know, is it about a shot that makes you go, yep, that's a winner?
Yes, but no. This one might be a bit of a surprise, but I think success is in photography is being able to afford to buy a camera and go out and shoot. I think that's the success there is because there's a lot of people, especially nowadays, that can't afford to go out and buy a camera. Even if it's an older camera that's a couple of hundred dollars, like a couple of hundred dollars is enough to break someone's bank these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, I really think the success is being able and privileged to go out and photograph whenever we want because we can. But in terms of success as business, it's when someone wants to buy your print and hang it up on the wall. I think it's really simple. It's if somebody else apart from someone that's outside of your circle wants to buy a print and hang it on their wall for a lifetime or for however long, I think that's success right there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the epitome for me.
Yeah. One of the keys that you mentioned is understanding your gear and so forth. How did you put in the hard yards to understand your field work and processing, and where did you get that skill set that backs up the creative vision that you've got?
A very long process, I must say. Very long process. So I throw out the manual of a camera when I get it.
You're a man. You don't need to read manuals.
I can't read. No, so I'll throw out a manual and I'll just pick it up and I'll have a crack, go through the menus and see what works and what doesn't. Long story short is I'll pick up a camera, I'll take a photo. I used to write down the settings and things like shot one, shot two, shot three, what I did, and then take it back. Kind of like that old film approach, but
yeah, right.
But digitally. So I used to do that a lot until I got it to where I wanted it. And then I've been doing long exposures long enough now to where you turn up to a location, you go, okay, you look around you and you go, okay, cool. It's full sun blaring at 12 o'clock. Okay. I've got a 15 stop filter on.
Yeah.
And then you can quickly calculate where you're going to put your settings, where you're going to set your camera up. But that comes with a lot of time. It's all trial and error. And yeah, I think personally, I think that's the best way. It's picking your camera up, playing with it, seeing what happens. Don't put it in auto as soon as you get it. Just put it straight into manual and stuff it up. It's digital. It's not film. It's not going to cost you. I think, I think you've done the same thing. You picked up a camera and you just went at it. Is that correct?
I did read a couple of bits of the manual when I upgraded from, I think my first digital camera was 500D. Canon 500D. And when I upgraded to the 6D, there's some menu options and the wireless capability and whatever. So I wanted to learn how to use that. I did actually read the manual there for some of those bits that I didn't know. But I knew a lot of the triangle and everything. I knew that from film days.
Mm-hmm.
I had the old Minolta XG1, which I started photography with, or it's more serious photography with, back in the 80s. And using that, I already knew ISO really wasn't a thing. It depended on the film you were using and you were stuck.
It was more ASA, wasn't it?
It was ASA/ISO. Who made the film and everything. But you were stuck with that for your 12, 24 or 36 frame.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't adjust that, but you had the other two to play with. You had aperture and shutter speed then to play with. And so I already knew that, and I'd learnt a bit of that back at school, back in high school originally, was where I first picked up a SLR camera. That was the first time I'd ever held one, was in high school. So, it was interesting then transferring that to digital when digital came along, because before I got the DSLR, I had a bunch of point and shoots.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you didn't even think about most of those things then. It was just wham, bang, take the shot.
It's ready to go. But that brings me to another point, and what you were just saying about you only had 36 frames in a roll of 35 mil film. That's also a good little technique, I think, for beginner photographers is to go out and only limit yourself to 35 images and then go back. And that's what I did as well, is that I coming through where I work in broadcast television, I have a lot of older guys that were there that shot film. And we would talk photography like till the days come home. Like we wouldn't even tell you what happened in the show or the footy game or something. We couldn't even tell you what happened. We were just talking about photography the whole time. And that's what gave me the idea was those older generation photographers and artists that would say, just go out, shoot digital, but only take 35 frames or 36 and then see what you come back with at the end, note down. And that's what I did. And that's where the trial and error came in. Was just, I think it's still relevant in a way to this day, going back and saying, as a beginner, take 36 frames, come back. Oh, okay, that didn't work. Go out the next day, take another 36, see what happens.
I actually saw a video. Adam Carnash, who's been on First Man Photography, as his
great show.
Yeah, he did one, I think, last week or the week before, I'm not sure. And it was literally about that. He turned off his back screen so he couldn't review his pictures.
Yep.
And he limited himself to, I think, 24 shots or something.
Yeah,
It was an interesting experience to see him use his digital camera like a film camera and not know what his result was going to be until he actually got back to the studio.
Have you done that yourself? Have you done
that? I've done it a few times, but to be honest, one of the reasons why I went digital was so I didn't have to faff about with crappy film stuff. I went through all of that.
Yeah, fair. You don't have to do it again.
Wait a week or two for your films to get developed and the photos to come out, and then you go, oh, yeah, well.
Yeah, I've done that.
I know there's a meme there, and I think it was started out with sort of film plate photography where you take six shots and six shots would be keepers. Then you got to 35 mil film and you got, I think, 36 shots or 24 shots or whatever the meme is.
Yeah.
And you got six keepers. And now with digital, you can take 1,500 shots and get six keepers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, back in the day, I think Ken Duncan, I'm pretty sure it was him. And he said, if you come away with 10 good shots per year, you're doing very well. And it's still true to this day, right? How many photos are we willing to put up on our
website? I've got years worth of stuff on there, but even some of those, I did a cull recently actually, and I got rid of a bunch on the website simply because I didn't think they were good enough and certainly not indicative of the quality of the stuff that I'm trying to do now.
Yeah.
I say trying. It's,
it's not... We're always trying, mate. Like everyone's trying. No one's perfect. Yeah.
That brings me to how do you deal with those failures? That experimentation process and trial and error means that there is an element of error. And in having that element of error, how do you deal with the errors? It sounds like you're using that to learn, which is, for me, the ideal way of dealing with it.
Yes. I'm quite cutthroat with my work. So if I get at home and I come home from a shoot, I won't look at any of my work until probably a week later.
Right.
Because I don't want any stray memory of that day coming in and taking away from actually looking at the image.
Yep.
Because it's all, for me, it's all about the detail, it's the line of the subject and things like that. So I might sway myself to think that it's better than what it was after the shoot because you still got that adrenaline pumping through your veins.
Yeah, right.
You still got that excitement from that shoot. Because you're like, oh, yes, I nailed that. And you look at the back of the screen and you get to the computer and you go, no, that's not good at all. So from experience, I'll wait. So I'll wait a week or two or whenever I've got time. Like I won't hit it straight after I take that photograph. So then I'll approach it. And then if it's off by one little bit of focus or detail, it's straight in the bin. I'm removing it off the cards and then I'm writing it down saying need to go back to this location. And then I go back there and I'll write down preferred conditions of the day. Like that day was, say, full cloud. Okay, maybe partly cloudy with a bit more shadow depth would work better for this day. Then I'll bin that photograph and then I'll go back down again. So that's how I learn from my failures. I don't keep them because then it's just clogging up memory on your hard drive. So straight in the bin and off shooting I go again.
And how have you found there been any sort of regrets? I know I've found a few older shots that particularly from the 500D days where, you know, the 500D sensor, it's what, 15 years old, something like now. So its low light capability was nowhere near what the 6D Mark II or what the R6 or R5 and all of those are now.
Yeah, yeah.
But Photoshop's come along and it's got noise recovery. AI noise reduction. So I've actually gone back and then the things that I would never have edited simply because of the amount of noise in them. Have you ever regretted throwing something out because the technology's moved along and you could have actually recovered it?
No, I don't regret not throwing any of them out, to be honest. If I do a trip somewhere, they're the ones I'll keep for that exact reason because it's going to be harder to get to those locations
again. Yeah, yeah.
Like I've still got files on my computer from my Europe trip I did way back in 2013, and I'm still processing those. So as in I'm going back to them with new eyes and looking at them after all these years and coming out with new ways to edit them and to make them to the way I want them. So it's not so much about the gear, but if it's home, I don't regret. If it's in Australia, I do not regret throwing any of them away because I know, hey, really, we live here, we can go back there at any time. But I also feel that if I leave them on the computer, I'm going to overthink them and go, oh, I could use this. But it's then effectively what I'm doing is degrading my own work and my own space about it. And that's just the way I approach it. I know a lot of guys that and girls that they'll keep all their files. all their raw files. And I'm like, what are you doing that for? You just got to have to go buy. For those who can't see, Grant just put his hand up. But
I'm really annoyed though. 2019 shots, I lost about half of my collection through a hard drive failure. So I had JPEGs backed up elsewhere, luckily, and I had a few of the RAWs backed up, but most of the RAWs went. So, yeah, there's a whole Canada trip that I don't have RAWs for at all.
Yeah. But the good thing about technology these days, you could probably bring a little bit of something back out of those JPEGs if you put them into you put them into Photoshop and then bring them through Camera Raw and you expand them and all that sort of stuff. There's things you can do now. Like back when we would have all started photography, there was nothing. Even with digital, you had to get it right. Otherwise, you're stuffed.
Totally.
But so there's pros and cons to deleting work. Depends on your workflow. My work's real minimalist, as people would know. So I try to keep my backups like that too.
Yeah, fair enough.
Everything just flows into one big category.
So you mentioned you live not too far from Wollongong and the Yellowarra Coast and whatever. You're at Wilton there. Is that your go-to, or are there other places that you keep getting called back to?
The places I keep getting called back to are too far away for me to go.
Yeah, fair enough.
Which are in England and Venice, mate. But if it's my day off and I've got a few hours before I've got to go pick up the kids from school, I'm down the coast. I'm shooting anywhere from Stanmore Tops all the way down to Jerringong or Jarrowa.
Yeah.
That's my spot that's where I go, because it's Wollongong's 25 minutes-ish from my place, give or take.
Yep.
Like Bulleye is about 30 minutes. Kiama's just under an hour. So I'm quite privileged in a way to where I live in comparison to the coast. But with my work, I also have my camera sitting in the car. So if I'm working on the Central Coast, I've got the camera in the car. I'm going out before work. Working in broadcast TV takes me to some pretty cool spots, like across the country as well. So if I have time, I'll take the camera with me. But yeah, I'd say the Illawarra is my photographic home per se. Yeah.
Do you think that's influenced how you shoot? You've mentioned the minimalist take that you got. Do you think the area that you fell in love with has had much influence on how you shoot at all?
As in fell in love with Europe and England or the Illawarra itself?
Either.
And where I am now currently with my work is influenced heavily by that first trip I went to in 2013.
Yeah.
I put that trip to be the pinnacle into my decision, into going into where I'm going.
Yeah.
It was a dream to go and shoot places like Swanage. I think you've been there recently. Last year, I think it was.
A couple of years ago, I did Swanage. Yeah,
it's like shooting there, photographing like Dirtle Door and going down to Dover and seeing all those things.
Yep.
Mind you, I stuffed up 90% of all those photos, but we won't go there. But yeah, that kind of was pivotal into the direction I'm on now. So I'd say yes, it does. That really set me on that direction, and it has made me adapt a lot to how I shoot here on the Illawarra now too. So I owe a lot to that Europe holiday, that Europe trip, but not just that, but also buying a lot of the English photo magazine, who gave me the inspiration to do all that and then bring that sort of that iconic look over there that a lot of photographers have, mostly because they have the wild weather, the fog, all that sort of stuff, which we don't really have. We do, but we don't have that here in Australia. Yeah,
got to pick where you go and when you go for those sorts of conditions.
And if you're doing it full time, that works because you have the ability to go out every day. But when you can't go out every day, I've gone, how can I get this same look? But here in Australia, which I'm not trying to brag or pump my own shoes up or anything like that, but no one was really doing that back then. Fogging out the backgrounds, there was no one really doing it. There was people like Christian Fletcher doing the real fine art stuff, which is iconic and fantastic. But the fogging out of the backgrounds and really bringing out that subject, there wasn't doing that sort of thing. So there wasn't much information out there of how to do that. So I had to teach myself in Photoshop, which was grueling, but that's what we do. I'd say 2013, that trip to Europe, England and Europe was the defining moment for me.
Okay. So would you say you've got a favorite spot? Could be worldwide.
Yeah, okay. I do have a favorite spot. If you go through my, not my so much my website now because it's down at the moment, but if you go through my socials, I've only got one photo from there. That would be my favorite spot.
Yep.
This place holds a deep sentimental value to me, and that's North Narrabeen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd say my favorite spot, even though it's quite popular, it's relatively overshot without sounding like a bit of a prick on it. But I can see why. I like it. It's one of those cool little spots. It's easy to get to. But, yeah, it's that would be my favorite spot of all time, regardless of all the places I've been.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
that one's a bit unexpected. But
Yeah. It's because my emotion's key.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of photographers strive for in their photographs is emotion. And I find capturing images personally at Narrabeen, I can add that emotion into it.
Yeah, cool. Mm. What's your most memorable experience?
Okay, that's a tough one. There's a few. So memorable would be shooting the old pier, the old Swanage Pier in England. That was pretty... When I got there, I had to pinch myself a little bit, even though it was bucketing down rain and all this sort of stuff. And so typical English weather, it's raining. I still got out there and shot in the rain with an umbrella and all that sort of stuff. And that's pretty memorable to me. But again, I think one of the biggest ones for me would have to be, I captured this photograph at North Narrabeen Lake. Oh, sorry, the pool.
Yep.
From up high, and I photographed that, and it was definitely a breathtaking moment because it had been a spot that I'd been to many times over the years. Not many people had photographed from there, from this position, up on the cliff. So you climb up the cliff and you shoot down on it. I think I was there. I was there with my family for Christmas, celebrating Christmas as I had done for my entire life at the caravan park there, and I photographed that image there and come away with this. What I thought is probably the best photograph I've ever taken.
Yeah, wow.
I love it. And then I entered that into a competition, which is rare for me. I don't really do too many of them.
Yeah.
And that got, I think it was either 10th or 8th in the Mono Awards.
Yeah, well done.
Australian. Yeah, so that was pretty cool. But actually, no, I didn't enter that one. No, that one got picked up. No, sorry, I'll take that back. I didn't enter. I wasn't allowed to because I got picked up by Australian Photography Magazine and I got a little piece written about it. But that would be the highlight. I think that's the most one because it's got that emotion and then it was good enough to be picked out and I got to write a little article about that, like the meaning behind that image. So,
yeah, cool.
So that would, for me, would probably be, that would take the cake.
Yeah, nice.
So back to Narrabeen.
What about horror stories?
I've got plenty of those. I think I've drowned 4 cameras. I've gotten drowned those. I think everyone's gone down with a camera. Like the old days used to be, you get as close as you get to the water, the better.
That's it.
Nowadays, not so much. But I think I look at it as horror stories as a good way to learn as well. If I had to choose one, it would be the mistakes in terms of networking and things like tours I could have done with people because I was too busy out going clubbing. It would have been in my early 20s, so 20, 21 sort of thing, where every weekend I'd be out in the club instead of being out photographing and doing tours with overseas with people. So I was spending my money in the wrong place, but that's hindsight. So that's what I'd say would be my horror story, was opportunities missed, but hey, we all learn from it. That's another strange one where it's not quite what most people would hear, but I'd say for me, that's my horror stories, opportunities missed.
Well, what have you learned about the world through photography?
That it's a big place and that everyone has their own opinion about the landscape as such. But I think conservation, you don't really see that through my work as such. A lot of people won't take that aside, but I am very cautious of where I stand, where I put my feet, where I put my tripod, all that sort of stuff. If there's a plant there, it might even be a plant that will grow back tomorrow or the next day and so on. But I think that's the key. I know a few people have said this on your podcast in the past, that it is conservation. And I honestly think that we do need to really watch what we are doing out there. And
totally agree.
Even though we as photographers and artists are very cautious of where we stand, leave no trace, all that sort of thing, posting to Instagram and socials can influence these people, just your regular tourists, any regular person, just to go out to these locations and not, and they won't necessarily think about it. So you've got to be very careful. And that's where, that's what I think, is that we've got to be very careful in how we approach landscape, and geotagging's another one. So I don't think we should really, if it's a very volatile area, so especially in Tasmania after the fires and things like that, even before the fires, I think those guys that shoot down there a lot are very good at keeping that exact location quite quiet, just saying the general area, but you've got to go find it. But yeah, I think that's what it's taught me the most, is how to conserve the land that we're walking on, because really, see, there's a lot of plants and stuff like that can just die from over traction, and plus a lot of places are dangerous.
Yeah, totally.
Take Seacliff Bridge, for instance. We used to go, there was only a handful of us that knew how to get up there, like in the early days. And then a few people found it and then told everyone how to get up there, as in non-photographers.
Yeah.
And I remember going up there once, and I was wearing full hiking boots and I was slipping all over the place. And there were people up there in thongs.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there going, and that was the last straw for me. I'm like, I'm never going up there again. It's too dangerous. I don't want to show people I'm going up there. I took all the photos down from up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's safety. I think it's conservation and safety. So if we go up there, people are going to go up there. So
I think the last time I was there was about 20 or 30 people up there.
It's a nightmare. It is. It's just, there's so many people up there. It's just, they've worn the grass away and it's literally just dirt there now.
Yeah.
So if there's a bit of moisture, you can go over the edge quite easily.
Absolutely.
It's very dangerous. And so that's what I think. That's what I've learned, is safety and conservation, I think, are the keys that we need to be looking at as photographers.
Yeah, it's great advice. Great advice. Let's talk a bit about the podcast. So you and Carl Strand.
That's right. Yep.
What do you call it?
It's the
Gallery Podcast.
Yeah, that's right.
So how did you guys get started, and what's it all about for people that haven't listened?
Yeah, so it started, well, the conversation started probably about 5 or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Carl and I, a little backstory, Carl and I have known each other for close to 11, 12 years or something like that now. Yeah. So we met photographing. He worked with a mate of mine that I grew up with through school, and they were out photographing, and I met up with him after a shoot. So I met him, about 12 years ago or so, give or take. And so the conversation started about 5 years ago, I think pre-COVID, but then we put it on the back burner because of how busy we are and things like that. Like, he had a full-time job. I was either working every weekend and then moving where I live away from him at the time. I think he lived in Sydney somewhere. So it was about an hour drive, which is it's not too dissimilar now to where he is now, but so then we put that on the back burner. And then I think one day a year ago, so probably late January, early Feb last year, we're out shooting it'll come back to me, but we're out shooting somewhere on the Illawarra, and we were just talking about it. And I think I actually mentioned your show to him, because I was talking about one of the episodes and it was like how good it was, like just hearing the input from one of the landscape photographers. I think it might've been William Patino actually. Because we both knew William Patino from shooting on the Illawarra a lot back in the day, and through one of the groups that we used to shoot with. And then we were talking about that, and then it just came up to say, why don't we address that conversation we had 5 years ago and start our own? We're like, we know we're in different circles. We knew a few different photographers away from the ones that you had already recorded. So we were a bit stressed and a bit concerned that we're going to be overlapping a lot. But then we're like, we're all got our own approach, so it doesn't matter as long as we work together. And
this is that. The merrier, as far as I'm concerned.
And it inspires, as long as it inspires other people.
That's right.
But then we're just like, you know what? Let's give it a crack. It wasn't so expensive to do. So that shoot we already had, and I go aboard a gate when things like that come up. So we just started talking about it, and next thing we're like, what's the name? And we came up with all these ridiculous names. It's just like, let's not do that. Let's not that. I said, what is it that every photographer wants in their career as a photographer? And everyone's like, an exhibition, a gallery space. I said, why don't we call it the gallery podcast? Because we're all viewing. So it's like you're exhibiting somebody else's work, but just through a podcast. And we're like, then it stuck. Yeah. And as soon as that was decided, bang, Instagram page was up, ready to go. And yeah, so that's how it came about. It was just one of those things that we'd been talking about for quite some time. And it was like, you know what? Now's the time. Let's have a crack and see what happens. And then, now we're here.
People that haven't listened, what's your focus? Are you selling on my questions and asking them, or have you got your own?
No, we're using yours every day. No.
That's fine.
No,
I have listened to it, so I know.
Who are you? No. So we do listen to your podcast, and so we do try to pivot away from that and then draw from questions that may have not come up. But we don't structure anything. We don't ask. We don't put any questions down on paper.
Yeah,
we don't have a structure for a show. It's just a general conversation. So we just go, we call them up, then we draw a question from their answer, from their original conversation piece. Like, we'll bring them in by getting them to introduce themselves. And if we know their work, we'll then go, oh, what about this? Talk about that. And then what's your, and we, every answer, we draw a question from that. So it's not one question is the same to a degree. And that's how we structure our show. It works for the minute. We've had quite good feedback from our guests so far, saying it was just felt like a conversation piece, and that's kind of what we want. So everyone's in the room. And I'm sure you're the same. Like, you like to have everyone's welcome, even though it's like a one-on-one conversation sort of things. And that's how we like to structure it. It's just, hey, let's keep it easy going, see where it goes. If we talk about photography, we talk about photography. If you want to go on another tangent, so be it. We'll go with it. So,
yeah, cool.
Yeah, it's just go with the flow, our motto. On that situation, on that podcast.
I know you've had a few non-photographers on the show.
Yeah,
well,
that's right. So
really good. Yeah.
That was the original plan, was to have art as general, to break down those walls of between, oh, photography is not an art. Oh, artists are just this, like the infighting that happens, and the politics is just ridiculous. But what we found, we were doing a disservice to not just the artists, but to ourselves, because we know a little bit about art because we did it. We started off doing a bit of that way before photography. But then what we found is that we just didn't have anything in common with a lot of those artists. It's got nothing it's no offense to the artists. Like, they're fantastic. The artwork that those people were producing is great. And I'm probably going to buy some and put it up on my wall.
Nice.
It's just on a personal level, we just didn't connect. We struggled and we were mentally drained because we were trying to think about what was coming out and what questions we were going to ask, and which is not a bad thing, but it just, we kind of felt the flow just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And we're like, we can move back to photography, which we know about, but we won't restrict on what sort of photographers we get on. And that's why we started with the artists and the photographers. And now that's why you'll see now that we're down with mostly the photographers now.
Yeah, cool.
It's all a learning curve. And as you would know, it's, you learn as you go to what works and what doesn't. And at this point in our journey, the artists just weren't working for us because we didn't feel like we could really showcase them as an artist because we're not in that field. So we just didn't feel like we were doing them any service.
Fair enough. I guess one of the things both photographers, artists, and podcasters come up against are creative blocks.
Yep.
How do you deal with them, and what do you do when you're not feeling photography or you're not feeling the podcast or whatever? What do you do to get around it?
We just don't do it. We go do something else. No, I know that's a bit rough, but no.
Sometimes the best answer.
Yeah. Luckily for me, that if I'm not feeling it, I've got my kids, so they take my mind off a lot of things. And surprisingly, they're so creative as well. So if I can just, they love drawing. My oldest son doesn't mind taking photos either. He's got a little camera. So sometimes just hanging out with people can give you that creative kick that you need. There's no right or wrong answer with it, really. It comes down to what happens on the day. So I'm actually going through a little block at the moment, to be honest.
Okay.
So I haven't taken last year was a terrible year for photography for me. I think I only went out probably no more than 15 times, a handful of times. There was not many times that I went out because of time and stuff like that and other ventures and things like that. But that killed me. So in a way, and I'm struggling to get back into that motion now. but it's slowly coming back. But yeah, it's all a journey. So find that thing that you can. For me, I go out with my, hang out with my kids and go to the beach. So I'm not annoyed about not going out and shooting because I'm keeping busy. So I'm always busy. So I know it'll come back. Sometimes time away is good.
Yeah.
Like I had 2 years away without a camera, probably about 4 or 5 years ago. I went down with a camera and I had my first son and couldn't afford to buy a camera. So I was away from it for 2 years. And that's the best thing that ever happened to is to not have anything for 2 years. Been taking time, you come back with fresh eyes. So I honestly think if you've got a block or a block, creative block or whether it be financial block or anything, I think the best thing you can do is write it out, let it happen, embrace that time away from it. You'll come back and you'll be firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, let the passion build up.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And then you truly know whether or not you want to do something, like where you want to go. So instead of just going with emotions, you've had time to think which direction you want to go and you go hell for leather with it. So I think my tip would be embrace the time. Embrace that freedom and that time away from it.
What do you see as the future of photography and the biggest challenge facing it right now?
I've thought about this one and there is something that's a little bit controversial in my answer. And it's not to be, I don't want it to be taken as a negative because it's actually quite a positive. But I think one of the biggest challenges for photographers, and a lot of people might think it's going to be AI or financial, that they are challenges, but I think they can also be spun into positives as well. Yep. Everything can be spun into positive. But my biggest challenge in that I think I see facing photographers is photographers.
Okay.
And the reason being is because we're all trying to make it, right? So we all want to sell photographs. We've all been guilty of it. We've done it. Like I've done it. I know a lot of people have done it. So we're all guilty of doing it at some point. But I think photographers, that they're trying to make it as a photographer full-time, and I just don't think this day and age it's viable because there's so many out there doing a lot of photography. So what I've noticed that people are doing is they're dropping the value of their product.
They're
bringing down the prices just to make a sale. And what I think we need to do as a community, and I use this, I strongly believe we should be a community, not a competition. And that would be, we need to have this little thing is that don't bring your prices down, because what the outside person looking in are going to go, why can I buy that photograph cheaper over here? But you're charging. So what's going to happen is that then the public, if we degrade our own work, the public are going to devalue it as well.
Yep.
So I think we need to, as a community, we need to bump up. We need to respect everybody's work, no matter who they are, what affiliation they are, what group they belong to, or what photographers they want to emulate or be like. I think we all need to be one as a community, value out each other's work, prop each other up. So then the outside looking in see a cohesive art form, and then the value of our work will go up, and then we don't have to scringe for these cheap prices just to make a sale.
Yeah.
And I think that, I know it sounds really bad, it's not negative. I think it's actually just a way we've got to spin the way we sell it and the sale tactics that we've got to do, band together so we can become stronger together instead of fighting each other individually, because it's not going to work. And then that's where AI comes in and play, and that's where they take your sale.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. It sounds like I'm being a bit of a prick, but I've been guilty. I've done it. I've lowered prices before, and then I've just gone, no, I'm devaluing myself as an artist.
Better I think the biggest problem, and it stems from what you were just saying, is that there's a glut of photography out there in the market.
Yep.
In terms of sales, and the demand is limited, particularly given that there is so much free stuff online. And if people, you know, are looking for, whether it's a background for their phone or a screensaver or whatever it is, there's a lot of stuff out there that they don't have to pay for. And therefore the value of photography has dropped simply because of the volume that's out there and the lack of demand.
I totally agree.
I'm not suggesting people should drop their prices.
No, but I totally agree with you. There are a lot of free things out there, but at the end of the day, they're not the clients that you want.
No, that's right.
Don't lower your prices for somebody that wants something for free. It doesn't, like, businesses, you don't see businesses doing that.
That's right.
You don't see tradies doing dropping their prices because somebody wants it for $1,000 less. No way. So in my opinion, I don't think we should be doing that either, because you're giving your hard-earned knowledge and work away for nothing.
Yeah.
And it's, we've all done it. Like I said, it's just the one, there are a few people that can, like a few photographers out there that are keep doing it, and they think because it works for them and they're making a sale, they see a sale as a sale, but really realistically, they're not coming away with anything. They're actually still losing the time and the money and the gear and the knowledge. It's not worth it. So yeah, I think that's the biggest challenge for me, would be because it's such a hard line out there. I think people need to really stand together and hold firm on their prices and not lower them and degrade their work. So that's what I think. That it's harsh, but it is. It's true.
I totally agree. Yeah. What tips have you got for someone just starting out in landscape photography?
Landscape photography? I'd say just get out there, have a crack, put your camera on manual, throw the manual away. Or no, I won't suggest throwing the manual away because it can come in handy. I think the biggest thing you can do, I think there's so much information out there on YouTube now, podcasts, we all talk about our little, the gear that we use, we talk about little techniques and things like that. I think there's so much information out there. Yeah. Jump on YouTube. If there's something you don't know, first give it a crack. And if you can't figure it out in the camera, then resort to YouTube or something like that. But my first thing would be pick the camera up, turn it on, have a go. And if there's something you can't work out, then move forward onto YouTube. But that's just technical. But in terms of shooting itself and composition, I think, again, have a crack, set your camera up in a position. You go, okay, that doesn't work for me. Okay, let's move it over a half an inch, or let's go on another angle. Let's go, if there's a jetty, shoot it front on. Okay, you don't like that, that's fine. Okay, maybe I'll shoot it over here, or shoot it, just have a go, keep trial and error. It's cheap to take a photograph. You can just burn it and throw it away. It's not like it's film. So take as many photos as you can and learn from every single one of them.
Yeah. Cool. What's the best piece of advice or worst piece of advice anyone's given you?
Best, I could probably get both. The best bit of advice I've ever gotten was from Glenn McKimmon.
Mm.
And his advice was roughly about 13 years ago when I've been shooting for about 16 years now. And and it was that period where I was on an R and about black and white photography. He knew I had that passion for it. And he said, keep at it. He goes, don't care about what anyone else thinks. Just do it. And he goes, and that's what he said. He just said, hang tight, stick to your guns. You're doing great. He goes, no one's doing what you're doing at the moment. And he goes, and you've got a bit to go, but you're on the right track. And he said, just hold strong. And that was the best bit. That was the best bit of advice I ever got. Whether he remembers saying that or not, I don't know, but I most certainly do. And the worst bit of advice, I won't say who said it because that's not fair, but that person was trying to change the way I composed my minimalist work way back when. So when I was like still trying to learn it, and he was trying to coach me on how to do things. And I'm like, that's not work. He wanted me to frame up the way he framed up. And I'm like, well, you're a traditional landscape photographer. It doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
In my instance. But yeah, so that's the worst bit. It was, one was telling me to stick to the guns, which I think everyone should do, yeah. I should say. Stick to your guns, stay true to yourself, and then don't listen to the people that keep on telling you, no, don't do it. Do it this way, do it that way. Just do what you want to do. You're at the end of the day, you're the artist.
Yeah, you're in control. And
exactly. You nailed it.
Yeah, I actually agree with what you said earlier, that the best thing you can do is do what you enjoy doing until you don't enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, stop doing it. So if you're enjoying doing a particular style or a particular type of photography, well, keep doing it until you stop enjoying it.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you love very vibrant, oversaturated imagery, then keep making it.
Exactly. Go for it.
Not everyone will like it. Not everyone will hate it.
Sometimes we need more niche. I honestly feel that, I think that's another thing that can degrade photography as well. If everyone's shooting the same thing, and there's no creativity, of course, people are just going to go for the cheapest. Because why would I go? There's a shot of Cathedral Rocks. Why would I go and spend $5,000 on a shot of Cathedral Rocks when there's exactly the same photograph for $200?
Yeah,
it's a no-brainer. So I think there's got to be that creative. There's got to be that creative line as well. So be yourself as an artist. And if you like it, do it. If you don't like it, don't do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. <Yeah. laughs> What would you be if you weren't a photographer?
Probably doing, unfortunately, doing what I'm doing now.
Okay.
And that's working in broadcast television. Nah. Yeah. It's a good job. I get to travel the country and work on sport, so I can't complain. But at this point, it's nonsense to think that I wouldn't be shooting. Let's put it that way. Okay. I'll probably still be shooting. I just wouldn't be doing anything with them. But in the grand scheme of things, I'd probably just be doing what I'm doing and being a dad like I'm doing now. So everything would be the same except for the fact that I'm not shooting, if that was an option. But there's no option. It's never happening. Even if I don't shoot for 3 years, I'm still looking at photography, looking at gear. I'm not doing any of that. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, it's always going to be there, but at what capacity, I'm not sure. But I'm sure there's going to be a time where I'll probably have another 2 years off. So,
fair enough.
But yeah, I'm going to say there's no option for it. It's not happening.
Are there any photographers out there that I should be talking to?
Oh, there's a million that you could be talking to.
Yeah. I know that.
Yeah. But I've got a couple of lists that I know you're focused predominantly on landscape photographers, but I do have an Illawarra photographer who she does a lot of work for, it's like female body positivity. And she shoots, it's all underwater sort of stuff with the female body and things like that. It is quite controversial because they're not wearing anything.
Okay.
But you don't see anything either. So that's a plus. But yeah, her message is great. And I think for your listeners, I think as well, it would be a fantastic listen. And her name is Emma Kate Maggs. We've had her on our podcast and she's amazing. She's a talent. She's lovely. She and her work is unbelievable and it's different. But the message behind it is awesome. But she does do them like on the beach. So there is a landscape aspect to it, but the message is what's key. So I'd have it. If you could get her on, I reckon your listeners might get a little something out of that.
Okay.
It's all about female positivity and body as well and the emotion and all that sort of stuff. She's got a great story. I think that someone like her would be good to get on. Another one, I believe you're talking to Carl Strand at the moment. You got him on the cards. He's another traditional landscape. His technical knowledge of printing and camera setup and stuff is unbelievable. Yeah. So you could probably get a lot out of that with him, with technical knowledge, composition, hiking, all that sort of stuff. You'd have a great time talking to him.
Just trying to set up a date with him.
Yeah, no, I was talking to him yesterday. So I said, you need to get on, mate. Ariel, in terms of Ariel, I think Tim Raitt would be my go-to. He's a good bloke. Great. His knowledge of airplanes through his history with his granddad used to fly planes as well. Great photographer. His work, not just on the phone, but in print, it looks unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it. There's some great photographers out there, but for me, Tim is fantastic. I think a lot of people need to get across Tim's work. I think he has the potential to be one of the best aerial photographers in the country, and I don't use that lightly. And in terms of black and white photographers, I'm not sure if you've had him yet, but Alan Coppy, I've probably said his last name wrong, but
no, I haven't yet.
Yeah, but his work is fantastic. I've met him, I've seen it in print. His black and white work is unbelievable in person, and plus his new fine art sort of style, well, he's pretty sick too. It's pretty cool. So I think Alan Coppy. And then one last one who's a Hunter Valley based photographer in the same, very similar style to my black and white, but I think it's Steve Algie. His work is, his stuff is fantastic. There's a couple of shots where we are very close in terms of like the location's exact, the composition's exact, but the little bit of processing, but we're very close. He's very good as well. His work is fantastic. So there'd be some that I'd have a chat to, but I could have a list of 1,000, as you'd know.
Yeah, fair enough. Thank you very much for those.
No worries.
Anytime. I've got one more question for you, and it's the most important one I can ask.
Let's go.
Do you like pineapple on pizza?
Yes, all day.
They're easy.
I've got one for you. What about on a hamburger?
Absolutely. Pineapple and beetroot and and cheese and
give
egg.
It to it. Lettuce, everything.
And
give
lettuce it all. And tomato.
Yep. But would you have beef or chicken with it?
Beef only. And barbecue sauce only. You can keep that
That red stuff.
Sauce.
Yeah, get that. Get rid of that, mate. No, we don't need it.
And tomato sauce just doesn't work on a burger.
But yes, pineapple 100% on a pizza. But if I can, I'll have it on everything except for pepperoni, maybe. Pepperoni's by itself, mate. No, you don't put anything else with that.
All right. It's been wonderful having a chat to you, Dean. Where can people find your work and your podcast?
At the moment, you can find my work at deanmaguire.com. Deanmaguire.au on both Facebook and on Instagram. I'm mostly on Instagram at the moment. My website is down. Hopefully by the time this website, so the episode comes out, it'll be up and working. I've just got a new price list from a new printer. So I'm currently working through that. So that's why it's down at the moment. The podcast, you can find it wherever you listen to your podcast, and it's just the Gallery Pod. You'll find that on all services. Hopefully you get as much out of that as what you do from this one. Grant is an awesome podcast. And honestly, mate, I really do thank you for having me on. This is the first podcast I've been on as a guest. So I do thank you for that. You popped my cherry. I think running my own's made it a little bit easier to talk to you. But if you hadn't done this two years ago, mate, I don't think I would have been this upfront.
So, it does take a little bit of time to get used to chatting to somebody.
I'm not used to it. I'm still not used to it. So you don't really hear me talking too much about myself. But yeah, again, thank you. Thanks for having me, man. It's been great.
No, it's an absolute pleasure, mate. And thank you for being on the show.
No worries.
Thanks again for listening to Landscape Photography World. I hope you enjoyed the show, and keep listening because I'll be joined by some great guests in upcoming episodes. You can find my work in this podcast at grantswinburnephotography.com. I'm also on Vero, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Grant Swinburne. Hope to see you out shooting soon.